I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at Burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at Burrow.com/ACAST.
Chase Thomas podcast. The Chase Thomas podcast. My nephew needs me to record. See, I already hate it.
All right. Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Chase Thomas podcast, where I'm still the aforementioned Chase Thomas, and I'm joined by an OG of this very podcast, someone who just, he's been traveling the world, he's vaxxed up, making the trips all around the globe, hanging out with Boban, and somehow not looking short next to Boban, which is still just one of the more absurd things I've seen on Instagram.com, where you can find Yovan Bua of The Athletic, who covers the Lakers and the NBA at Yovan Bua. But it's a wild, wild thing, and Yovan, I'm not going to lie to you, that's still something that I just can't wrap my head around.
Apparently I'm 6'10". I will take it. I'm not, but I will take it.
I mean, you've seen the picture, like you're in it, but like looking back, you look at it. Do you see what we're all looking at here, where it's like, I don't understand how this is possible. Cause like you said, you're not 6'10" and I know you're not 6'10". You're tall, but you're not that tall.
Yeah. I think that there's a optical illusion element to it where I'm a little bit closer to the camera, and I think we've seen in certain photos where the closer person looks a lot taller than they are. He's also bending his knees a little bit. I mean, I am pretty tall. I'm 6'5" with Air Force Ones on. I'm probably am 6'6". So it's not
all right. That's enough. I don't like this conversation anymore.
It's still a 10-inch difference. It didn't look like that in the photo. So, But it was funny seeing people's reactions and guessing my height. And it was just that was a cool. It was hilarious because I'd been in Serbia for like 2 hours and just walking down the street, run into Boban, and
So that wasn't planned. That was by accident.
No, yeah. We were just walking down the street, and I ran into him, and then we chopped it up for like 10 minutes, and and my girlfriend, well now fiance, then girlfriend, just took a photo of us while we were talking. So I was like, this is a funny photo, so let me post it.
How is he? How is Boban?
He's good. He's good. He's, he goes back to Belgrade every summer and spends most of the summer there, but he's happy in Dallas and excited for the season. So, he's Boban. He's the happiest person, you'll ever meet.
Okay. Have you run into any other NBA players? Maybe a Ben Simmons, perhaps, this summer?
No. But I haven't been in Philly, so I do have decent odds of running into Ben Simmons.
Exactly.
And he does hang out in LA a lot.
Right. The discourse on NBA Twitter today about Ben Simmons' latest is just, it's a lot. Like, nothing's changed. So a lot of the stuff, I'm like, nothing's popping up. The John Wall for Ben Simmons stuff, like Ben trolling on Instagram, putting up John Wall stuff there is rather funny, but Daryl Morey is not doing that. It's not happening. But then like you look at the deals around the league and I'm like, I don't even know what he can do. Cause if Damian, like the thing about NBA trades and what is difficult, I think, for a lot of fans is that like the other party has to want to do something like that, or player X has to want to be involved in this, or player X is going to sign off on this thing. And Damian Lillard has given no indication that he wants out. Bradley Beal has given no indication that he would be open to being moved for Ben Simmons. Like, none of these things are happening. So when you throw out the best Ben Simmons trades, it's like, well, those might not be options because they're literally not available. So what is Daryl Morey supposed to do? And if the Kings don't even want to get involved and like move Hield and Bagley and Picks and Fox for Simmons, whatever, like, then there's nothing you can do. Like, Morey might be in a situation now where like a lot the best assets he can get for Ben Simmons, those teams are like, I mean, we would be interested, but like our guy doesn't want to go yet. Like, he's happy. So, or it, maybe not even just happy, but he's cool staying here for a little bit longer. And then you're like, uh-oh. But the worst to me, I don't know if you feel this way, but the worst is the Timberwolves stuff. Like, it, the photoshops of Ben Simmons with Towns, Russell, and Edwards. Like, that's how Daryl Morey is not giving you Ben Simmons for none of those players. That's not how this, like, no, Edwards is gone. Like, Edwards is immediately in that deal. Like, you're not getting Ben Simmons without, like, that's the starting piece is Anthony Edwards. I don't know. I don't know what to make of it. What do you make of all of it, Jovan? And could you see the Lakers and or the Clippers getting involved here?
I can't really see either LA team mm-hmm. getting involved. I just don't see, you know, how financially how that works. I mean, the Lakers would probably have to trade Russell Westbrook, right? Like, they just don't have the money to do it unless you're accepting a package of like THT. Kendrick Nunn. Oh. I mean, they don't even have picks. That's not happening.
Yeah.
Or the Clippers, I guess, like if they're super, you know, if the Sixers are super high on Terrence Mann and you know,
yeah.
But like, you know, they probably have to flip Paul George. And I think there might have been a chance, you know, a year ago that could have been a possibility coming out of the bubble. But after the season Paul George has had, I don't see how he gets flipped. So I think the Ben Simmons thing is fascinating because there's so many parties involved that are polarizing on NBA Twitter. Mm. It's, you know, first and foremost, Ben Simmons, right? And you know, depending on who you know, what feeds you're following and who you're talking to, some people still view him as like a top 20, top 25 guy. Some people are like, you know, this guy isn't even a number two on a title team and, you know, is worthless. And you can kind of go back and forth in that. You got Clutch Sports involved, which is always a polarizing topic, and Rich Paul and the way they do business and the way they, you know, their stars can kind of dictate where they end up going. You have Daryl Morey and, you know, him being arguably the most famous, you know, general manager and decision maker in the NBA right now, at least on Twitter. And, just sort of him pulling trades out of, you know, seemingly nowhere and kind of being able to extract maximum value in a lot of instances. Like, he's in an interesting spot. You have Doc Rivers, who kind of incited some of this with, I think, his post-game comments after they were eliminated by the Hawks. You have Joel Embiid, you know, NBA Twitter's hero, who everybody, you know, seemingly loves. And then, as you said, you got kind of the CAA stuff and kind of the Timberwolves hanging around. And there's just so many things that I think are interesting and so many interesting dynamics just with the parties involved. This really is whatever you make of it, right? And I think, again, Simmons is just such a polarizing figure in the league with just his skill, you know, what he can do versus what he can't do, the way he carries himself. This is kind of another lightning rod topic of how much say should a star have when they're unhappy in a situation. You know, he signed that 5-year extension. He's only a year into that. Mm-hmm. So this is just like a... to me, like the perfect storm of all of the things NBA Twitter gets worked up about in one story and in one, you know, future transaction. So I'm fascinated by it, and I think it's going to be really fun to see how this all unfolds.
I think it unfolds poorly for Philly. I don't see how they get out of this unscathed. Like, I think they're going to be worse than they were a year ago. I think this sucks for them because they're in a weird spot where they cannot make any deal that gets back young guys. The problem with Anthony Edwards is Anthony Edwards is not going to be a prime, just number two on a title team in the next 2 to 3 years. Like, Embiid is nearing 30. I've said in this podcast for a while, like, this is not something you root for. I love watching Joel Embiid play basketball, but like, the injuries are just piling up and the history is there. Not a good history of big men like him aging well and just continuing to be a number one option with his usage and what he's asked to do on both sides of the floor. I think there's gonna, we're not at the precipice yet, but we're inching closer and closer. So you have to flip Ben Simmons for somebody like a Damian Lillard or Bradley Beal who can keep your Eastern Conference title window open. But bad news, if those guys aren't available, there's nothing you can do. And then you're like settling for a bunch of picks. And I mean, I just don't think that the player's there. The guy who can actually step right in and run with Joel Embiid and keep this thing afloat. So then you're just like, I don't know. Daryl Morey's in an unwinnable situation. And you mentioned Doc. Like, I went back and watched that quote because I think Ryan Cole from the pod posted that again. But it's like, if Ben Simmons is getting all worked up about that, and then you saw that report about he knew that boos were coming, like him showing up at wherever preseason camp's going to be. And I just, all of this screams like, this man is not the mentally strongest person I've like athlete I've come across in a while. And I think Andrew Sharp even threw out, he's like, after doing some thinking, Ben Simmons is the least cool NBA star of all time. And it's just like stuff like that. I'm like, yeah, I mean, this is all like not that he didn't get it that rough. And a lot of this stuff is, I don't know, man, if you want to be a star in this league in a big market, like this comes with the territory and you brought a lot of it on yourself, but you can fight back. If you're going to be a star, you have to fight back and face adversity and face this criticism head on. But he's running from it, it feels like to me. And doing the Sixers dirty in the process, I think, is also fair. Like, this is just a bad look. But I forgot who, I think it was Sam Esfandiari of Light Years pointed this out. I don't know if you saw this, Jovan, but he was like, this happens all the time in the Premier League, where like this is commonplace of, yeah, who cares that you're 1 year into your new deal? Like this is a common thing in UEFA. And this is what Adam Silver wants the NBA to be. And like, he's made no bones about it of just being like looking at the Premier League and looking at the Champions League and just being like, I like this. And just being into that kind of format. That is where they're looking, and just stars moving around a bunch and stars moving from one mega market to another. I don't know. I just know that two things. One, Ben Simmons is going to a place where he is not going to win as many basketball games as he was here. And two, the Philadelphia 76ers title contention window will be closed after you move him, because there's no deal as of right now that they can get for him that's going to up his value and also keep their window open in the East. I don't think it's possible, unfortunately.
Yeah, I pretty much agree with most of what you just said. The one thing I'll push back on is I do think it's rare for a coach and a superstar teammate to take shots at a star player on the team the way that they did, you know. And it wasn't, I guess shot might be a little strong, but
that's what I'm saying. It really wasn't that bad. Like, it wasn't that bad.
But I do think asking, you know, I think in that moment, you know, I guess it depends how you honest you want people to be. And I think us in the media do favor honesty. So I guess from that perspective, I enjoyed Doc's candor. But if you're looking at it from Ben Simmons' perspective and just from star players, and, you know, these guys have massive egos that they have been, you know, coddled to an extent. And that's just part of the game. Like, you know, we can complain about it all we want, but that's just how it works. If you're a star, you get a certain level of preferential treatment and coddling. And I think typically in that situation, a head coach would defend their point guard and be like, you know what? You know, that's a ridiculous question. Of course, Ben Simmons is a championship level point guard. Like, even if you don't mean it, it's all about the public image. And for him to react the way he did, I mean, he might as well. He didn't say it, but he might as well have said, I don't believe Ben Simmons is a championship level point guard. And that was basically the you know, reading between the lines. That was the messaging in that statement. And then you did have Joel Embiid taking some passive aggressive shots. And we know that they've had a bit of a rocky relationship. And there's been a little bit of a tug of war behind the scenes of who's the guy and whose team is it. And obviously from the outside, we all said Joel Embiid, but Ben Simmons is a former number one pick. And there was a time he was viewed as kind of the next coming of LeBron James / Magic, and maybe not on that level, but he was very highly touted coming out of high school, coming out of LSU. So I think, he clearly has a massive ego, right? Like, I don't think I'm going out on a limb saying that he's like in the 1% of the 1%. You can kind of see it on his social media. So like, I get why Ben would be probably more sensitive to that more than other people, but you've also kind of seen that and him kind of, I think part of that power dynamic behind the scenes has been him not necessarily feeling he's been treated the same way as Joel. So I also think as an organization, you have to know how your stars are with certain things. And maybe one player needs a little bit of more kid gloves and it needs to be handled a certain way in the media. And to me, Ben kind of fits that. So for them to kind of come out and have basically the two biggest voices publicly in your organization go against him, I understand why he would be upset with that. It's just something you don't really see in the modern NBA. You know, I think 10, 15, 20 years ago, that stuff was more common and people were more honest. But the last 5 to 10 years, it has just become, you know, publicly you prop up, you know, you lie to the media, you prop up your stars, even if you don't believe in them. When you have chemistry issues, as I'm well aware of with the Clippers a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. you deny.
Yeah.
And in the moment, it's all about saving face. So I think that to me is the one thing I push back on is I get from Ben Simmons' side why he was upset. I did think that with the way the modern NBA is run media wise, they did kind of cross a line for how stars are treated, but they weren't wrong.
But you also just got paid the max. Like, this is part of the deal. Like, they paid you. They're paying you as a cornerstone piece on the number one team in the East. Like, I don't know. I just don't feel like they backed it up with the money. Like, they're like, we invested in you and this is what happened. Like, doesn't matter. They should not have lost the Hawks like in the second round. That should not have happened. And they were all angry and they were upset. And part of competition and this kind of series, and when the expectations are just sky high, I mean, I understand why they're all so frustrated and so annoyed and just over it with Ben. And then we see more videos this offseason of him shooting threes in the gym.
This is also fascinating to me because we just rarely see a guy hold out this way. Like, mm-hmm. You know, we hear, okay, I'm not going to re-sign when I'm a free agent in a year or two, or, you know, he's unhappy and like you hear half measures, but we rarely see the full measure of just I'm straight up sitting out. Mm-hmm. And I know like Tristan Thompson did it a few years ago, and there's been like rare cases where it's more of actually like a role player kind of holding out for a contract they think they deserve. And we know for role players, like getting that deal is probably more important than even stars just because of how fleeting it can be. But I think it's also kind of fun to see, like, this has now become a game of chicken of, is Ben really going to sit out all of training camp and into the start of the season if they don't move him by then? Is he willing to potentially not only lose money in the form of not getting paychecks, but also getting fined on top? I mean, like, we don't know if they're going to pay him. Like, you know, they can choose, you know, both to not pay him and to also fine him, which would be a double loss of money for him. So it's a really interesting, you know, situation. And if I'm Philly, I am trying to trade him as soon as possible. This is not salvageable. So the best, I mean,
like, but what are you getting for him? Like, Jovan, when you look at the league, who are they trading him for right now? Who's actually available and who's actually on the table that can keep their timeline consistent with what Morey and Embiid want?
I guess CJ McCollum. I don't love that.
Then you're not winning the East. You're worse than you were a year ago.
Yeah, but I don't think there is a, like, I don't think you're winning the East either path, because your two options are you trade him for a worse player, or you keep him. He's clearly unhappy, and you know how is that going to affect the locker room? He might not even play for them, but if it does get to the point where it's early December and he hasn't played and they haven't moved him, and he just says, okay, I'll play out this season, move me in the off season, like, you know, do you really want to bring him into that situation? Maybe, but I still think you have the same issues as the past, you know, three or four postseasons if you're the Sixers, where his lack of shooting and just offense, you know, passiveness and indifference, that is a huge, you know, red flag and an issue in the playoffs. So I think they're in a tough spot. I also think if the reporting is true that he did give them this heads up almost a month ago or around a month ago, I think that that's partially on the Sixers too, because I think at this point, you know, Clutch has shown when they say something, they mean it. They back it up more so than I think almost any other agency right now. So, we saw with AD, kind of, he wanted out of New Orleans. He basically stopped playing the last couple months there. And now the situation with Ben, like, I just think and I'm sure the Sixers have been doing their due diligence and have been trying to trade him. So I don't think that's necessarily the case. But I also think it's kind of at the point where you almost have to take the best package available, because I just don't see a better alternative.
It sucks. But, you know, that's where we are. What doesn't suck is the Bash Bros, or whatever that hoodie Kawhi was wearing, talking about Marcus Morris and, was it Morris and George on the hoodie that he was wearing for the new Inglewood Arena?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. He looked thrilled, having a good time. Steve Ballmer remains one of the weirder humans I've ever seen. Dancing and that whole thing was just all very strange. And then it's amazing that we're still in 2021, that people are still doing the weird shovel and dirt photo op. Like, what? Why are we still doing this? Who's into this? Who's into the shovel to dirt photo op? Why is that such a thing? But that was weird. And then you saw Lawrence Frank on the end, just really uncomfortable with the whole situation. But what do you make as an LA native, Jovan? Then we'll get into some Lakers. But what do you make of this arena for them and Inglewood? Do you think this will change anything with the Clippers in the long term and their fan base? Is it going to be a huge boon to get them out of Staples?
Yes. I can say firsthand, as someone who has covered the Clippers, for almost a decade, those 12:30 weekend games were brutal. And it was always, they were playing at 12:30. The Kings or the Lakers were playing at 7:30. And I don't know the Clippers' exact record, but I know it was under 500 on those weekend home games. So for them to, I mean, again, it was, you know, the Friday and Saturday nights were for the Lakers. So they got that, you know, date night in LA, kind of the cool vibe of I'm going to a basketball game, I'm going to a Laker game. The Clippers didn't get that, and they really got the short end of the stick in terms of scheduling. So, and you're even seeing it this season where, you know, look at their back-to-backs versus the Lakers. Look at their, you know, 5-7 and 3-5, like all those, you know, 3-4, like all those things are just, you know, lopsided. And part of that is the scheduling and the way Staples is run. And it's Kings first and Lakers second, and then Clippers a distant third. So I think for them, once they can get their own arena, be able to control their schedule, you know, that alone should help them a little bit on the court. I don't know, you know, 1%, 5%, whatever that is, but that should be a boost. I think giving their fans their own arena and just their own space is something that's important. We know about the covering up the Lakers banners and sort of, you know, even the seats in Staples Center are purple, and that's for both, you know, more so for the Kings, but it also suits the Lakers as well. So I think just all those little things, you know, you walk around Staples Center, you do see more purple and gold. You do see. Just even on like the concourse and stuff, that there's Kobe and Shaq, and even the Sparks are purple and gold, right? So it's like, it's just, there's so many things in Staples Center that make it clear it is the statues outside. Like it is such a Lakers arena that for the Clippers to get their own space to be, you know, 30 to 45 to even an hour away from downtown and just kind of have their own part of the city, I think it's huge. Now, of course, Inglewood has the history with the Forum. It is more of a Lakers city, just as LA is. But I think the long run, having this nice arena, you know, what looks like it's probably going to be the nicest arena in the NBA whenever it's done, that I think that's huge for the Clippers. And that's what they need. That's why you have an owner like Steve Ballmer, who is the richest owner in, you know, North America and North American sports. And I think that's good for them. So it is, to me, nothing but positive. And there's always going to be the jokes. And, you know, it's always whenever the Clippers have some type of press conference, it's like they're doing something cool or serious and like, you know, trying to make it this spectacle. And then it always ends up like Kawhi or somebody goes viral for something like the Kawhi Paul George, just them looking depressed watching the live performance. But I mean, that's just part of being
what was happening in that performance.
That's always going to happen. But I think it's great for the fan base, and it's great for the organization to get their own arena in 3 years and really just separate from the Lakers and make it even add more to the rivalry, I think, because now you'll actually be going to two different arenas, and I think it'll just be a different vibe.
Absolutely. What were they looking at? What was that video? What was happening? Was it juggling? What was happening?
It was, I don't know that it fits in something that band. I don't know.
Okay. Yeah. They were not entertained. I would not do it. I would just be like, I'm a franchise cornerstone, not coming. I'm not going to be a part of it. That's not on my itinerary. As a recluse, I would just be like, no, that sounds like an awful way to spend an afternoon. Not doing it. I can barely walk as is, limping around. The Lakers, Jovan, the team that you cover that did it, just a really weird offseason for the Lakers. And I talked about them a little bit on this offseason here on the podcast. But like, before I write a lot about them in the next couple weeks, what sticks out to me is just that like I am way lower on their 2021-2022 than a lot of smart NBA people. And that concerns me because a lot of people are like, oh yeah, they should be able to bounce back a full offseason that AD did not have last year. We've talked about that on the spot, I think, of just him not being able to do his normal month off after the bubble. But I also just think they're still going to rest. And this is still a really old group of guys. And this is still a situation where I'm like, they were a 7th seed last year, and you cannot win the West. Like, there was so much talk about the bottom half upending the top half, and then all four top seeds in the West won their first round series, and the number 2 seed went in the West, and then the Bucks being the, 3 seed or 2 seed? I don't even remember now. Are they 3 or 2 this past year?
The Bucks were the 2...
Because they had home court over the Nets,
they're
right?
The three because
or they were three. Yeah,
have home court.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yeah. So they were three. So 2-3. You're not getting through the playoffs if you're not one of the top 4 seeds. And I'm like, the West is stacked, and they're stacked with teams that are going to pile up regular season wins. And I just don't know how the Lakers can rest enough and also pile up enough wins to get in the top 4. That is my biggest hiccup with this group, is that like LeBron's going to take time off, AD's going to take time off, and they're going to hope that they can just be a 6 or 7 seed and still run the Western Conference gauntlet. And I just don't think that's going to happen. So I'm like, I just don't put them in the contendership status that I do with as other people do. Is that a fair assessment, like a fair worry that I have that just hangs over my Lakers thoughts for next season?
Yes, I think we're in different camps in that I'm more of a regular season optimist, and I think my questions with this group are in the postseason.
Just flipped.
I think that, you know, just looking at last season, for example, I really think you could go back and look at the past 2 seasons, and you get the vision of the roster, but I don't think... I wouldn't say either of the past 2 Laker teams were the optimized versions of rosters you'd want to put around Anthony Davis and LeBron James. Yet 2 seasons ago, 1 seed, roll through the playoffs, win the championship. And yes, there was the bubble and the Clippers had their collapse, and no one predicted the Heat to make the finals. So like there were definitely variables that went their favor, you know, went in their favor, but you can only kind of just look at what happened, and they were the 1 seed. They won the title last season, 21-6 at the time that Anthony Davis goes down, I believe, with AD and LeBron in the lineup in the regular season. Their win percentage would have been top 2 in the West. So, you know, right behind Utah. And you saw in that first round against Phoenix that they were up 2-1. Probably would have lost game 4 even if AD doesn't go down, but AD does go down in that game 4. They end up losing that, lose the series in 6 games. So I think there's like an alternate universe where they're a top 3 seed last season. They make at least the conference finals, and we are having, I think there is just more general optimism on the Lakers. But, you know, I think sometimes the discourse gets a little too focused on last season and kind of the result. Whereas, you know, if a lot, that was because LeBron and AD missed 63 games in the regular season. And of course that can happen again. You know, LeBron is 37. You know, AD is obviously, you know, you can pencil him in for 10 to 15 missed games at a minimum each season. So you know, that can happen again. I just kind of view it as, I think Russ is really going to help them in the regular season. I think that we've seen him with some bad supporting casts in OKC and even in Washington last year, you know, just find ways to get wins. Like, he's the guy that it's Tuesday night in Detroit. You don't really have the juice, and Russ is going, you know, the team's maybe functioning at like 70% energy. Russ is still at 95-100%. Like, I think he, and there will be times where I think AD or LeBron maybe gets banged up. In the past, they maybe would have tried to play through it because they know if I rest tonight, we're going to lose this game, and they will be able to rest. And Russ will get you the 35, you know, 15 and 10 and help you win. My thing with the team is when we get to the postseason and the margin for error is slim, how does Russell Westbrook actually fit in? Because, you know, when in doing research for just Russ and his fit, I went back and watched his offensive possessions against the Lakers in that 2020 series in the bubble. Mm-hmm. And the Lakers could not care less about where Russell Westbrook was on the floor. They were guarding him with Markieff Morris, Kyle Kuzma, and Anthony Davis. And, you know, technically Russ was functioning as the center in those lineups. They were using him as a screener, as a role guy, kind of functioning around the elbow and trying to have him take guys off the dribble from there. But, you know, we know the lengths that Houston went to maximize Russell Westbrook around James Harden, basically getting rid of, I mean, literally getting rid of all of their centers and just rolling with, you know, I guess PJ Tucker at the five technically, but Russ was the offensive five. And the Lakers just didn't care. They happily played off of him 8 to 10 feet routinely on possessions. And there were several times a game he'd blow by somebody, get a layup, draw a foul, whatever. But for the most part, they were fine. And there was also plenty of times where he would have an advantage, but he'd take a step back, take a pull up and prick that shot. And it would just be like, what, you know, what are you doing? So I think to me that there's more questions with this team in a playoff setting when you can actually game plan for them. You could ignore their shooters in some cases. You could ignore Russ. You can game plan for that. And defensively, I have a lot of questions with this group because, you know, that's been their identity for the past two seasons. They've had some of the best perimeter defenders in the league. Alex Crusoe is an elite perimeter defender. KCP is a solid 3-and-D guy. Even Wes Matthews, Danny Green, like those guys help defensively. To lose that and really what was the core of a top three defense both seasons, this group to me is going to struggle to even be top 10. Like, I think if they're top 10, give Anthony Davis Defensive Player of the Year and probably make Frank Vogel Coach of the Year, because I just don't see the defensive personnel, especially on the perimeter. So I think I have more concerns with the playoffs and how some of the pieces fit than the regular season. I think regular season, you're going to have Russ doing his thing. You know, they have some shooters and scores off the bench. Like, I think the offense is going to be top five. It's just, to me, the defense is
top five in offensive rating.
Yeah.
Really?
So. Yeah.
Okay.
But again, like, so to me, I'm penciling them in as a top three seed. I think it's them, Utah and Phoenix are the top three in some order.
Not Denver.
But no, I just think because of Jamal. If you told me Jamal was healthy to start the season, then Denver to me is in that mix and maybe even the favorite. But we don't know when Jamal is coming back. And if it is January, February, March, I do think, because Denver was quietly coming back down to earth in the last few weeks of the regular season. Mm-hmm. We saw, I mean, they did crush Portland, which to me says more about Portland than it does about Denver. But, you know, we saw them go up against Phoenix and get swept. And
yeah,
I mean, they were decimated injury wise, but I do think, I don't know if they're going to have the same magic next season until Jamal comes back. So, I mean, I'd put them in that 4-5 mix for me, but I do think to me the top three is Utah, Phoenix, and the Lakers.
In that order?
Because
I do have, we're on the same page maybe. If you have Utah where I do, because I have Utah 1 in the West.
Yeah, I mean, I personally, I'm out on Utah in terms of, I think whoever they're playing in the second round, I'm probably going to pick that team over them.
Mm-hmm.
To me, there's a lot of Clipper energy with this group where you know, just every postseason there seems to be some type of collapse. Or I mean, they blew the 3-1 lead in the bubble.
Yeah.
They blew the lead to what was it, 2-1 or 2-0 lead to the Clippers and lost all four games, including two of them without Kawhi Leonard. And I know Mike Conley and Donovan were a little banged up, but you got to beat that team, at least force a game 7 without Kawhi Leonard. And you know,
when Terrence Mann decides the series is over, that series is over. You know this.
Yeah. So, I think there's a lot of teams. Like, I think the Clippers, they're a hard team to peg because to me, they're probably a 6-8 seed. But if Kawhi comes back, they could push for home court. Mm-hmm. I'm really high on Golden State. Golden State, to me, I think people are sleeping on that.
They're the wild card for me. I have no idea what to do with Golden State. No clue.
Like aside from, to me, if everyone's healthy, my top three in the West are the Lakers, the Clippers, and the Nuggets. I think the Clippers proved it last season. You know, almost made the finals, including playing without Kawhi. The Lakers, to me, I think it's an imperfect fit, but I think they have three top 25 guys. And then Denver, we've seen their magic in the playoffs, and I just think that Jokic Murray connection is special. So that's my top three teams healthy in the West. I might put Golden State fourth.
Okay.
At their peak. Now we don't know if they're going to hit that. We don't know when Klay Thompson's coming back. We don't know what state he's going to be in, but I think the idealized version of Golden State is really, really good. So,
I am not convinced that they're going to do the Spurs model that they're claiming, that they're like, we're going to bridge two eras and we're going to ride with Wiseman and Moody and, who was the other guy they just drafted? It was Moody and why am I blanking on?
Kuminga,
yeah. That they're going to try and bridge the gap. I don't believe that at all. I think when Klay comes back and if they're playing good basketball and they're flirting with that top 4 or 5 seed in the West, Wiseman and some of those guys are on the move and some picks are on the move because I don't think Steph and Klay and Draymond are going to sign off on the Spurs model of, yeah, we'll wait on all these young guys and y'all can just keep carrying a heavy burden and we're not going to go big fish hunting, especially with Iggy back in the fold too. I don't know if they make a bigger move, because I'm still concerned about the depth. I like the Otto Porter health, Andrew Wiggins still being someone they count on, and then that 5 spot. I don't know. We'll see with Golden State for me. Can Curry do this again? Carry this kind of heavy burden offensively again? I don't know. I mean, he's my favorite player to watch in the NBA, but you know, we'll have to see if he's still doing this. But I don't know. I think it's tough. The West is just a bloodbath. The East, 1-12, is pretty solid. But like, who do you even have as like the worst team in the West next year? Is it obvious to you? Because for me, I'm just like, I don't know. It might be the Spurs.
It's probably OKC for me.
Okay.
It's OKC or
but Houston. Do you think they're going to lose enough games to be the worst? Because I just think that they're going to play too hard and Shea and Dort, and they're going to be coached up too much that they're going to win just enough to be like the third or fourth worst.
I would have a tough time seeing them not be bottom three, just because I think it's more of a talent thing than anything. Because like you might have just named the only two like NBA players on that roster. Like I know.
Wow. Shot to Poku. Cheeky,
but I mean, like it, like current, like guys that could contribute to a contending team right now, it might literally be Shea and Lou. And yeah, Houston, I think, is also in a similar situation. And we don't know what's going on with John Wall and Eric Gordon. And
Houston's definitely going to be there.
Yeah. So I don't know. I don't love Minnesota. And San Antonio. I mean, San Antonio is finally kind of coming back down to earth in terms of overachieving their expected win total, I think in terms of like talent versus their actual win total. I think it's coming back down to earth. We kind of saw it last season. So, I mean, that to me is a 25 win team. I actually disagree with, looking at the Vegas over unders, they're kind of penciling in a lot of parity and sort of the league being a little bit more balanced. To me, there's still a top six or seven, and then another kind of tier of another six or seven.
Who's your six or seven? Who's your top tier in the West that you're talking about here?
I think as currently constructed, I think the West could only be won by the Lakers, Suns, or Jazz.
Okay.
I think now, when does Jamal Murray come back? When does Kawhi Leonard come back? What state does Klay Thompson come in? I think you could add those three teams depending on the answer to all three of those questions. But I'm saying, like, as currently constructed with what we know, that, you know, there's a chance Jamal or Kawhi is back by January, February. There's a chance neither of them plays all season. So it's just, you know, if Denver doesn't have Jamal Murray, I think they're probably losing in the first round unless they play Portland again. The Clippers, similar thing. I think they're losing probably in the first round. Golden State, it depends on the matchup. But so I would say those three. And then in the East, to me, it's it's more Brooklyn and Milwaukee and maybe Miami. I don't think Philly, as we discussed at the beginning of the podcast, has a real shot. You know, barring a miracle where they get Dame Lillard back or Brad Beal or a star on Ben Simmons level or above it, I don't see Philly actually, you know, winning the East. So it's probably, to me, the three in the West, the other two in the East, and then maybe Miami kind of punching its way into sixth.
Okay. I don't hate it. True or false, Russell Westbrook will be a Laker this time next year?
True. There's no alternative.
I think it's false. I don't think this goes well come playoff time, and I think it's over. I think this is a 1-year experiment that they're like, oh yeah, this is a terrible idea.
If it's an abject disaster, I could see that. I think you're lower on it than I am. To me, like, the floor is, I think the floor of this is a top three seed and losing in the second round. I think the ceiling is winning a title. I'm currently more on the side of, I think they lose in the finals or conference finals. My official prediction is Brooklyn over the Lakers in the finals. That is entering the season. That's my prediction. But I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, because I also think it's just like how, because again, I didn't think last year's roster was perfect. And some of those pieces, you know, Dennis Schroeder, Montrezl Harrell, even Marc Gasol, like on paper, kind of entering the season, you were high on the fit and you're like, oh, this makes sense. Like, you know, they want Mark is this kind of 3-and-D center. You know, Dennis will be the change of pace point guard that can help the non-LeBron lineups. And like Trez is the sixth man of the year. And you don't need
who was the biggest advocate for Schroeder last year? Do you know
who was?
Yeah.
That I don't know. I mean, I would assume maybe LeBron, just because he's always talking about wanting more point guard help. And I know he was Russell Westbrook's, you know, one of the biggest advocates for him. So I think LeBron has kind of wanted that co-ball handler that can alleviate some of that burden on him. But again, kind of going back to last season, like, it was not a perfect roster. It was not a perfect fit. And yet again, like, they were winning at a top two seed level. And like, it's just, to me, it's kind of just as simple as you put LeBron and AD on the floor, and there's going to be a lot of matchups in which they have the two best players. Like, you know, playing against Phoenix, they have the two best players. Playing against Utah, they have the two best players. And that's not to say Donovan Mitchell or Devin Booker or Chris Paul or Rudy Gobert can't, you know, match Anthony Davis. But entering that series, you know, the Lakers, like, but okay, play Brooklyn, play Milwaukee, like play some of these other teams. Okay, that's a different conversation. But to me, it's just like, sometimes I don't know. Sometimes I'm.
But are you certain that you're going to get 100% LeBron and 100% AD for a full playoff run again?
That's a good question, and that I can't tell you. I do think that Anthony Davis was the most vocal about the short off season, and it was something he complained about well into the season and well even after his first injury, of just how, you know, and I had an interview with him early in the season, and he told me, he's like, you know, every off season I take like 3 to 4 weeks off. I don't touch a basketball. I don't work out. I go on vacation. I spend time with my friends and family. I completely unwind and detach from basketball. Once that fourth week is up, I'm back in the gym going, you know, ramping up to 100%. And I have 2.5-3 months to get myself right and get ready for training camp. The issue last season was they finished in mid-October and training camp started in the beginning of December. So Anthony Davis still took that, you know, 3 weeks off and then had 2.5-3 weeks to ramp up and just never got into 100% shape. And, you know, if you just look at his frame, he did look a little hefty, you know, hefty by AD standards. He did look a little bigger. He was a little slower. He didn't dunk the ball as much. I mean, you go back and watch the 2019-2020 highlights from Anthony Davis. He's dunking everything. He's catching multiple lobs a game. He's playing above the rim. He's blocking a bunch of shots. That was not the same AD we saw last season. He was settling for jumpers, doing a lot of pick and pop, playing further from the basket. And I think we have, I mean, look, everybody looks good over the off season. Everybody looks good in you know, the highlight videos and the photos and stuff, but Anthony Davis does look visibly slimmer and trimmer. And there's been a lot of buzz that he's going to be playing the five and that he's going to start.
I've heard this. I've heard this before.
He's going to play more five next season. That was part of the mm-hmm. Westbrook deal. But I've also been hearing that there's a growing case for him to be starting at the five. And mm. that is a sacrifice that he is now willing to make to make the Westbrook partnership work. And that this kind of is a three-way sacrifice where it's like AD, you're going to need to play the five more. You're going to need to slide over from the four to the five, play your natural position and the position of a modern big. You know, LeBron and Russ, you guys are going to need to share the ball handling. And when you don't have the ball, you need to be cutting. You need to be screening. You need to be active in ways that you maybe haven't in Russ's career, maybe ever. And in LeBron's career, maybe, you know, since Miami. So I think it's going to require a level of sacrifice from all three guys. And part of that for AD is going to be, you know, playing more at the five. So I think you get AD at the five, that is the optimized version of him. And I do think there's a chance, you know, that we see this works out very well. But I think a lot of it's going to come down to ultimately Russell Westbrook's fit, which I'm, you know, a little skeptical of, obviously, and the shooting and just sort of, you know, Kent Bazemore, Malik Monk, Wayne Ellington. These guys are all coming off of career shooting seasons. Can they keep that up in LA where they're going to be sure to get a lot of open shots because teams are going to be playing off of the Lakers shooters and packing the paint against them. So can those guys continue to make shots? That to me will be a big determinant in how this team fares.
So I have a question then. What would you guess? It is September 21st. Do you remember? No. What would you guess the top five man unit per plus minus? 3 months into the season, which five-man unit do you think has the best net rating?
To me, it's going to be... I think there's... Okay, so the big three. Mm-hmm. And then to me, there's three candidates for the two spots. I guess my official prediction will be AD, LeBron, Trevor Ariza, Kent Bazemore, and Russell Westbrook. Okay. But I also think there's a chance Kendrick Nunn is in there as... you know, kind of a smaller two next to Westbrook, and Bazemore or Ariza is out of the lineup. But to me, I mean, I think the biggest thing for the Lakers that to me would have completely changed how I feel about this team. And you know, I would have really put them potentially next to Brooklyn was the loss of Alex Crusoe. Because again, I think looking at the biggest differences from the past two seasons versus this season's roster is the perimeter defense. And, you know, they lost Alex Crusoe, KCP, even Kyle Kuzma was a productive defender at times over the past two seasons. Like, they just don't have the same defensive weapons. And they still have Anthony Davis, they still have LeBron, they still have Frank Vogel. I think the front court's fine. Like, Dwight Howard is a step up over Marc Gasol and Montrezl Harrell. I don't expect much from DeAndre Jordan, but maybe he'll play a little bit. But like, you know, Trevor Ariza, Kent Bazemore, they can help in the front court. But who's guarding Dame Lillard in a playoff series? Who's guarding James Harden and Kyrie Irving in a final series? Like, I don't know the answers to that, because if it's Russell Westbrook, that gives me a little bit of pause based on what we've seen from him defensively throughout his career, especially in recent seasons. So to me, the defensive thing is the biggest difference, but I view Kent Bazemore and Trevor Ariza as the best quote unquote 3-and-D options. You know, Bazemore's coming off a season. He just shot 41%. In Golden State. Granted, it was on 2.7 attempts a game, so not a high volume. Trevor Ariza is a career 35% three-point shooter. Not great, but you know, decent enough to hit open threes coming off a season in which he was a starter in Miami playing almost 30 minutes a night. So ideally, both of those guys are kind of low 20-minute, you know, 18 to 24-minute a night guys. But I do think with the positional versatility that they have, and particularly being like really the only other role players that can defend, I think they're going to add some value to the lineups with the big three. So if I had to say, it's probably those five, but there's a chance Kendrick Nunn is really good in his role as a spark plug off the bench, kind of becomes the sixth man in this group, and he's productive next to Russ.
Okay. I like it.
What would you say?
I I don't think it's going to be
none of them.
No, I don't think Kent Bazemore, I've seen a lot of Kent Bazemore in the last couple of years. I mean, he shot well last year. I don't know. I would not rely on Kent Bazemore to fill the Danny Green role in 2022. That really scares me. I don't think it's be Kendrick Nunn either. He doesn't. I think Trevor Ariza will be one of them. I think you're right there. I think he'll be one of the four. But can I say he's not on the roster yet? Can I say that I don't think he's there? I don't think that fifth person in that best plus minus five is on this roster right now. Like you said, the Caruso spot, I don't know. It's not Kenneth Faried. Saw he worked out for him. I don't think it's Kenneth Faried. I don't think it's DeAndre Jordan. I don't think it's Rondo. I don't know. Is it Isaiah Thomas? No, I'm just kidding. I don't know. Like, I look at this and I'm like, there's not a good answer here. I think just with AD, LeBron, and Westbrook alone, they'll be fine in that department. But I'll throw a wild card. I think maybe it's Wayne Ellington. I would trust Wayne Ellington more in this spot than Bazemore.
I think that's fair. I mean, I've been predicting Wayne Ellington as the starting shooting guard from the jump.
Mm-hmm. I think that dude only shoots threes. Have you gone through his scoring logs? We laugh about Tony Snell getting his cardio in, but Wayne Ellington, 2 for 7 from three. He's done this at least 93 times in his NBA career. That man knows what
important.
He is.
That's important. Mm-hmm. And, I think the concern is that, and this is where, again, I think you really need to start AD at the five, is that if you are starting Dwight or DeAndre as a placeholder, I mean, one, the spacing is just god awful with Russ, a paint bound center, and then LeBron and AD. Plus, I don't care who you're, unless you're putting Ray Allen, Klay Thompson, Steph Curry, Reggie Miller in that spot. And even then, you're just probably going to put one guy's going to guard that guy and then stick with him. And it's everybody else, we're just going to play off of you and let you shoot. So I think that the spacing is really a concern if you don't have another wing in there instead of Dwight or DeAndre. And that's where, I think my current prediction for the starting lineup is AD at the five, LeBron at the four, Kent Bazemore at the three, Wayne Ellington at the two, and Russell Westbrook. And I think that kind of gives you some offense defense. Kent Bazemore, I think my concerns, the concerns are twofold. He is very mistake prone, and really it's on both ends, where offensively, some of the turnovers, some of the shot selection, defensively, he tends to foul a lot. But I think, just by virtue of him probably being the best non-LeBron perimeter defender. Trevor Ariza to me is more of a four at this stage of his career. And he started at the four in Miami. According to Basketball Reference, he played 93% of his minutes last season at the four. So you're not starting Trevor Ariza to guard point guards. Kent Bazemore can do that. And again, you ideally want him.
Malik Monk cannot do that, just for reference. No.
And Kendrick Nunn is okay defensively, but kind of trends. He's an average to below average, but yeah, Malik Monk, Carmelo Anthony, these guys aren't doing that. Even Talen Horton Tucker, I don't think is ready. And then also he's not a shooter, so that presents its own issues. But my official prediction is Bazemore and Ellington both starting. I think if they do start an actual center, it's Bazemore versus Ellington. And now you're just saying, do we want offense or do we want defense? Because if you go Ellington, yes, that's good for the offense and it's going to need some spacing. The issue is he's not a good defender. And now you're just again, you're matching up with Portland. You're putting Wayne Ellington on CJ McCollum. You're putting Russell Westbrook on Dame Lillard. I just don't love that. So
I don't either, but you're still getting through Portland.
You get through Portland, but okay, Phoenix.
Yeah, Phoenix is more of an issue.
Who's guarding Devin Booker? You're in a really tough spot. So I think it's that. My biggest question other than Westbrook is just the perimeter defense and what the Lakers do to. Frank Vogel is one of the best defensive coaches in the NBA. I think he's really good at maximizing his personnel, playing to their strengths, kind of figuring out what they can and can't do and really putting them in positions to succeed. So I do think we're going to see a vastly different defensive scheme from the Lakers this season. But in the past two seasons, it was very much pressure, 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 trap, rotate, scramble, and use the speed and quickness and elite one-on-one ability from a lot of their perimeter guys. They don't have that anymore. Unless Russell Westbrook goes back to 2008 Defensive Player of the Year at UCLA, Russell Westbrook. And LeBron, I guess has to take maybe a step back offensively and a step up defensively and really handle more of that burden. Like, I just don't see it. So I think a lot of it's going to come down to how great is Anthony Davis at erasing some of these mistakes or limitations, and how great is Frank Vogel at concocting a defensive scheme that can kind of maximize, some of these limited strengths that they have on the perimeter.
Absolutely. Jovan, how do people find your work?
You can find me on all social media platforms, including TikTok, where I'm becoming more active during this season, at Jovan Buha, at JOVANBUHA, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, all that good stuff. Check me out. And then also check me out on The Athletic. We currently have a promotion for 50% off an annual subscription. So if you subscribe off of one of my stories, you get a 50% off, and that helps me out. So please do that.
Go do that today and keep up with Jovan as the Lakers season gets started. He is the best in this biz. Jovan, thank you so much for the time. Looking forward to talking actual basketball with you this season yet again for year 37 of you and I on this very podcast. So Jovan, continue to stay safe out there, and I will talk to you soon, my friend.
Sounds good, buddy.
All right, the Tuesday edition of the Chase Thomas podcast rolls along, where I am now joined by a first timer who covers a very good AFC North team who's 1-1, but one of those losses coming to maybe the best team in the AFC and the Chiefs. But they got a win this weekend against the Houston Texans, the mighty Houston Texans. People are saying the mighty Houston Texans, just the scrappy underdogs. Holly Wetzel is here. Holly, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm good. Hey, I'm coming off a Browns victory, so my week's starting out pretty good, I have to say. How are you?
I'm good. I've spent a whole offseason defending the Browns.
Well, that's good. We need as many as we can get. I mean, that's just how it is.
I mean, I was all in on their offseason. I was all in on this group. I shouldn't say was, past tense, because I still am. And they continue to play the Chiefs close, which is great. I mean, yeah, obviously your rival just played them close and actually won on Sunday night in historic fashion. But, you know, Baker's been good. The offensive line's been good. The defense, I have some questions about that we'll get to. But let's start with Sunday, the first win of the season. What happened in the Houston Texans game? What did you see for your Browns?
Yeah, you know, look, we just real quick, we had some pretty glaring mistakes, right, off of week one versus the Chiefs. So that's we had some pretty major turnovers that really made a major difference on, how the game ended up falling. But we bounced back, 10-point win, right, 31-21 over the Texans. You know, it was an interesting game. The first half was pretty sloppy, in my opinion. The Browns, we turned the ball over twice. We gave up a good amount of yards to the Texans offense, which included 4 of 6 third down conversions. So it was a bit of a rough first half, but we ended up recouping, and we seemed to figure it out on the offensive side with some pretty awesome touchdowns from Chubb and Hunt and Demetric Felton, actually. He had a really cool touchdown. He had caught a short pass from Mayfield. He did like this really cool spin move and broke a tackle and went 30-some yards into the end zone. So we did bounce back. It was a weird game, though. Like, it's interesting being a Browns fan. And I think just overall, I think, and maybe you agree, Chase, or not, do you feel like maybe we are, as fans, obviously we all overreact for the most part in every position for every game. And I know we have small sample size, right? We just have 2 games. But the emotion and the major reactions that come off of these games sometimes are ridiculous. I mean, I know we'll talk about the defense, but there people in Cleveland right now are calling for Joe Wood's head. It's just insane. So
I think the overreactions are part of it. I think also, and this is coming from somebody who has the unfortunate task of loving the Atlanta Falcons and watching them every Sunday. I don't know if you knew this or not. They have the worst point differential in football, and the Atlanta Falcons are off to a horrible 0-2 start. It's been brutal. Been a brutal way to spend 6 hours.
I feel your pain. I feel your pain.
Well, what would Browns fans know about pain and suffering?
Right.
What would they know? But also, go check out Brownstown on the Blue Wire Podcast Network, if you have not already. Great podcast about this very, very topic. But I think what we're learning about the preseason going from 4 games to 3 and coaches more and more not valuing the preseason and valuing the first couple weeks of the regular season to figure stuff out is playing out in real time right now. Like, the Falcons didn't play any starters all preseason.
And the Chiefs did.
Yeah.
I mean, that you do have to question that. And I know people are going to be up in arms, but that might make a difference of why, I mean, up until last night, right, that, the Chiefs were, at least under Andy Reid, I believe, were undefeated in September.
Mm-hmm. So I think that's a big thing. And I think we're going to revert back to the old way. It's like, we have to play some. Like, these guys have to get reps in the preseason. You can't just take the preseason off and use the first couple weeks because you might be out of the season. Like, if you start off 0-2, we know the history there. If you are not ready to go and your guys can't just flip the switch like that, then you could already be in too big of a hole to climb out of.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. No, it's definitely something that I know I get a lot of pushback on when I talk about that, but I think that they should play more. They're going to get hurt. They're going to get hurt regardless.
Mm-hmm.
If they're out there at least getting a couple reps, I mean, we got to see the Browns, right, in Atlanta,
mm-hmm.
In preseason, and Baker got out for a couple series, and that was it was good for the fans, but it was good for him. It's good to get the timing down. It's good to get the talking through, you know, all of that stuff. So to get rid of it completely, I don't agree with. I don't think it's worthless by any means. I think the dual practices, I got to see one this year, is definitely a really cool idea. I think that should definitely be amped up, but it's intense there too. There's still arguments and fights going on. There's still, you know, a lot of intense and energy going on with those dual practices. So I'm with you. I don't think it's going to go away. Plus there's too much money to be made. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, that's what it's about. So
I thought it was for the love of the game.
Oh, well, come on.
I thought. I thought it was for the love of the game. I was told that Kyle Pitts already loves Atlanta and Julio Jones was the Falcon for life. I was told all of these things. Is Baker okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Man, let me tell you something. Mm-hmm. He is tougher than tough. I can't even, like, he basically made a comment about how they, like, popped his shoulder back in.
Ugh.
And he went back out. Like, that's just... If there's one thing that you should never question is Baker's toughness. Like, you can question a lot of different things, but that one thing about him, he is such that like nose to the fire, like down home, like ready to go, just chip off his sleeve, like ready. I think that's the analogy. He's just ready to go. Like, he's such a badass. And I feel like he doesn't get a lot of credit on that. And quite frankly, though, at the same time, I know that fuels him. He likes being the underdog. And for us last year, I think from last year to this year is really that underdog mentality has definitely, it's carried on. But there's so much more expectations for the Browns this year than there was last year, which is because, first of all, but they kept winning and it was like, oh my God, this is crazy in a COVID world. I mean, we didn't even have our coach for the playoffs, first game of the playoffs. I mean, it's just a lot of that, we just kept kind of defying all the odds every week. Mm-hmm. And so when you get into this year, things definitely that the expectations jump up, you're scrutinized, you're under definitely a magnifying glass and Baker's fine. You know, If grading him for the first 2 weeks of the season, I mean, he leads the NFL in completion percentage to the first 2 weeks, 81.6%.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's crazy. He has the highest rating a player has had in the first 2 games of the season. His completion number, like I said, is just off the charts. He's been incredibly accurate, and he's operating Stefanski's scheme, which is being asked of him for each throw to throw as optimally as he possibly can. So he's stat wise been blowing it out of the water. And I really think this is just the beginning for him. So he's okay. Thank God. Cause I'll tell you, my heart kind of skipped a beat there.
It looked bad.
it did look bad. And now we got, speaking of injuries, we got, you know, on another note, we got Landry out, Jarvis Landry out for 3 weeks, which is a tough swallow, which at least it's not anything more severe.
Well, we'll get to Landry because that's a bummer because I think he's been graded as a top 10 receiver in football per PFF to this point.
Yeah, he's been great this year. He's such a leader on this team too. A lot of guys look up to him, and he's, you know, our wide receiver position has a lot of depth. I'm happy about it. You know, so we do have other guys that are going to cut. They're going to come up. We have some tight ends that can catch. Two good tight ends that can catch. So there's a lot of still opportunity on the catching side of the ball. So it's a hard loss about Landry, but Baker is really back to him. He's been so impressive already this year, and I can't wait to see what he continues to do.
We'll have to see what Dennis Northcutt's up to.
Come on. I tell you what.
Spot start thing... for Northcutt, yeah. Joshua Cribbs?
Oh, please. I'll tell you what, he's actually got quite the career going on post-football here in Cleveland, mm-hmm. Mr. Josh Cribbs. He's all over. Him and his wife host like a local show. He's
really
very involved in the community. Mm. Oh, yeah, he's like all over the place. So he's doing pretty well. Look, I don't want to like completely forget about the Browns' past. I think that that's mm-hmm. you never want to. And I would in the beginning when Stefanski got here and Baker and these players came and OBJ came here, it was a lot of, well, what do you think about the past? And they'd be like, I don't want to talk about the past. I want to focus on the future and what we got going on right now. And I'd be like, well, yeah, you kind of have to answer those questions. Like, that's who we are. Those are legitimate questions. And I always try to stand up for the media in general because I just mm-hmm. think they always get a bad rap. But now I'm like, I don't want to hear about it anymore. Can you please move on? Like, I'm fully aware that we used to just completely suck for many, many, many years. And I think that plays into our entire, I guess, fear of and completely jumping the gun when something happens, like fire Joe Woods. It's like, okay, well, why don't we just take a break? Because we have some really great weapons on defense, and I think we just need to gel.
I think you got to get Greg Williams back in there.
Oh, are you being serious? I hope to God not.
I am not being serious, but he was a
candidate for head coach, which is pretty insane.
Wasn't that per Greg Williams that he was a candidate for the head coaching job?
Well, no, I think that came out. That was legit.
Okay. Well, I am also a candidate.
He might have believed that he really was a viable candidate at that point. But and look, when Stefanski got signed, he wasn't my first choice. Mm-hmm. But I'll tell you what, not only do I love looking at that man, he is smart. He's super smart. So
there you go. I mean, hey, it's important. It's important to, like, as we learn with Andy Reid, how a coach looks plays a pivotal role in whether or not you'll win a title. OBJ's impact, though, we haven't talked about him at all. Not played to this point. How has his absence affected the Browns?
So the OBJ thing's an interesting one because I feel like we're getting mixed answers out of Berea, Ohio, wonderful Berea, Ohio, of what's going on with him. You know, basically in the beginning, he was like ready to go week one, right? And then it was right before the game started, you know, he's out, he's not playing. Then we fast forward the week, it was Wednesday, the week before the Texans, I think it was Wednesday or Thursday. It was, you know, he's not playing, he's not ready. And we were like, okay, you know, that last week he was ready to go, now he's not. And now then there was some back and forth about like, well, why can't he come in and get just a couple reps, right? Why can't he just come in and do that? And they're like, well, no. If he's not ready, we're not bringing him out. But then we had Grant Delpa come out for a couple reps to get his, you know, feet wet. And now the new storyline kind of come back out as well. He might come out. He still might play now this coming Sunday. We have the Bears and he might play. So for a couple series. So there's, I don't really know what's going on. The OBJ thing has always been quite the mystery. He's not really had, you know, he's had a couple really great, amazing games, and we see him out on the practicing field. We see him out there catching these crazy, you know, one-handed catches. I mean, he's just, and he is an enigma. I got to see him in person. It's unbelievable. Actually, my brother was at the Atlanta game, and was texting me, was like, he just looks insane. Like, I can't explain to you. I mean, so there's, we know the talent is there. That is not the question. It's just, there's something off, and there's a lot of weird storylines kind of coming out of Berea. And I don't really know what's going on. They're saying he's going to play. I trust Stefanski. I really do. I think I know he knows what he's doing. And I hope to see that chemistry with him and Baker. You know, I think last year, that need or that automatic feeling like I had to throw to him because it's him, and that pressure is gone now because Baker, I think, is way more confident. He has a lot of different moving parts now that he can go to move the ball forward. And on top of that, you know, OBJ is, he had to also kind of, I don't want to say fall on any sword because I think that would be a little too drastic, but I just think he had to kind of get with the game plan. It's like, you want to be a part of this, then this is what you got to do. This is who it's a team sport. You got to think that way. And so I think that he's definitely come a long way on that side of things. And I hope he plays on, they're saying, well, week three was the week he was coming back. So I'm like, okay, if that was the plan all along, then let's just see it. I mean, it's been a weird, weird preseason leading up with him. And again, weird, weird storylines coming out of Berea. So I'm hoping at this point, it's just, let's move forward, especially with Landry out. We need him. We need him badly.
And we're confirmed Landry's 3 weeks.
Yeah, at least. Yeah, because okay. He's on the IR, so yeah.
So who are the top three receivers going into this week? Who gets the most reps?
Well, you know, I would love if OBJ is playing, right?
Mm-hmm.
I really like, Demetric Felton, I'd love to see more of him.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going on the rookie end, staying on the rookie end, I should say, Anthony Schwartz.
Ooh. You know, track star from Auburn.
Yeah, he's pretty amazing. Pretty amazing to watch. So I would love to see him out there again. There's going to be, you know, we got a running quarterback coming up. It's going to be Justin Fields this week versus the Bears. So, you know, I want to, which is going to be another problem, hopefully, for the defense to get in front of. But I'd like to see Anthony Schwartz out there too. And Donovan Peoples-Jones, you know, and God, here I go. And, you know, Hollywood Higgins. I mean, we have
Hollywood
a lot
Higgins.
Of really great weapons. Mm-hmm. So, you just asked me to name three and I named five or six because I can't choose. So,
well, that's good. Mm-hmm. That's good. Yeah. I like it. And also for them, like, I don't know if you've seen the left tackle spot and how cursed it is in Chicago this season. So I don't know who's going to line up at that spot for Cleveland, but I know Clowney has not played well to this point. Garrett's been Garrett, but not quite his elite self, but he's been good, just not elite. And then you have Clowney, who's been bad through 2 weeks. So I'm curious to see where he stacks up against this weak Bears off the line. Because my guess is the Browns feast there a little bit. On Sunday, who do you think showed out the most for you against the Texans, and who struggled the most visibly?
That's a good question. You know, the Nick Chubb just always shows out. He's unbelievable. He ran the ball, only 11 times, but collected 95 yards and a score. And I just our run game, Kareem Hunt, right? He added 51 yards on 13 carries. So our running game, I go back to Chubb. He's just such a reliable, good, always go to player that's every week. So I would definitely have to say Chubb had a fantastic game. Definitely rebounded from week one. When he fumbled that ball, boy, I felt, my friend and I were watching the game, and I turned her, we kind of said at the same time, we're like, if that hurt, that hurt nobody more than it hurt Nick Chubb. We could feel as bad, but Nick Chubb feels the worst. Like, there's no doubt about it. So he's definitely my show for sure. Who wasn't, you know, can I just say the defense in general? I just feel like there was, our timing's off still. I just feel like, you know, we got seven new starters on defense. There's just still a lot to kind of gel and get them together. I'm not worried about the defense as a whole. I think we're going to be fine. People asking, trying to get Joe Woods fired at this point is just insane. But I think it's just going to take some time to build. So I would say we just have lacked defense for sure. And then I do want to say, you mentioned Miles. It's interesting with him. We're still kind of waiting for that major, like, Miles breakout moment. I mean, he was like MVP last year. I mean, every game was just insane right before he got COVID. And after he got COVID, he was not the same. It was a really, really tough recovery for him. He was having a really hard time breathing and trying to get back to himself. And we kept kind of waiting for him to make these big moves at the end of the season, especially in the playoffs. And it didn't happen. So I'm waiting for him to kind of break out. But just the defense in general, I just think we're not there yet. But I do feel like we will get there.
Okay. What do you think has been a bigger position of strength, the defensive line or the offensive line to this point?
Oh, the offensive line for sure. Mm. We have one of the best offensive lines in the league. I mean, it's just
any weak spots.
Give me Baker. Give you weak spots
on the offensive line. Who is it? It's not Treader. It's not Wills. Who is it?
Like to name names.
You gotta name names. You gotta do it. They look, if there's one thing I know, Holly, it's that the Cleveland Browns offensive line love this podcast. Joe Thomas follows me on Twitter, and he makes sure that the weekly episodes go right to the feeds of the Cleveland Browns offensive linemen. So this is something that will get them riled up, get them ready to go for the week ahead.
That they're gonna be like, oh, Holly Wetzel said this about me. Well, hell,
100%. Yeah. This is an opportunity to encourage, to motivate.
Look, our offense line is definitely stacked. They're giving Baker, the best thing they can do is give Baker time, which they have been, and they're giving him a lot of time. So that takes that pressure off of him, and he can obviously be as accurate as he's been. I don't have any complaints so far on the offensive line. I just don't. So, get with me like mid-season, and then we'll chat because things might change. But for right now, no, I'm happy with everyone so far. I want to stay healthy. I worry about that big time. So you know that's one area that is always just unpredictable. So, but I have like I said, I have faith in Stefanski and his scheme. He's the man. So. I'm going to plead because I like everybody. So.
Okay. You like everybody.
I mean, yeah, for right now I'm going with yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I like it. You know who it couldn't be? Couldn't be me. Jalen Mayfield, Matt Hennessy, Cale McGarry. Couldn't be me.
Well, look, I want to say I feel bad about it, but I don't, because I know exactly, and I've been there, and nobody gave a shit about Browns fans. But look, we actually have a really good strength, and I'm sticking with it. It's ebbs and flows of the game every week. This is what happens. Not everyone's going to be perfect. There's going to be some issues. Penalties, sure, I'll go off penalties. Right, we made some really stupid penalties across the board on both sides of the ball. So we'll see. Speaking of, did you in the Texans game? What in the world was the Cully punt decision? Did you see that? Okay. So early in the second quarter, Houston was at 3rd and 15 from its own 38-yard line. And Tyrod Taylor found Brandon Cooks for 13 yards, and he set up a 4th and 2. Okay. Then Tack McKinley, of course, he jumped offside.
Falcons legend, Tack McKinley.
Meaning, so... Texans had another shot, right, at picking up the first on a 3rd and 10, or they could decline the penalty and roll the dice, obviously, on the 4th and 2. And Cully decided to punt on the 3rd down. So he declined the penalty, and then he punted.
Did he know it was 3rd down?
Yes. So they asked him at the end, they're like, he said, like, well, we felt apparently, well, here, I have his quote. He says, we felt like that at that point. We felt like we could have had a chance to be able to get better field position to hold them. We didn't make it. We didn't get it. So then someone asked him, couldn't you have just gone for it on the third down again, right? And then punted. And he said, well, we could have done that. And looking at it again, I'll have to look at the situation and see what I would do next time. It's like, what the hell? I mean, it was stupid. So, you know, we, and honestly, I will say about the Texans too, I was a little questioning of whether or not if Tyra Taylor had gotten hurt, had he not gotten hurt, what would have happened? I mean, he was on fire, which is scary. So, you know, it was, like I said, it was just an interesting game. It was a weird win. I'll take it. You know, and just moving on. I want the W. I don't want to analyze it. It's more than, you know, normal humans do, but, you want to just take the W and go.
Absolutely. Third in offense per PFF to this point. They are most excellent at what, in your opinion?
Say that again.
So the Browns right now, they're third in offense per PFF.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. What are they most excellent at? Why are they, what was the biggest reason that they are the third best offense in football right now?
I mean, I'm going to go back to this. I mean, they're blocking. They're giving Baker the time. I mean, I think that that's the most important thing. They're protecting him, and they're giving him the time to make an accurate throw and complete the pass. So for me, that's a really – and it's a lot. It's like a couple – it's a good couple seconds. And he's getting his time, and that's – what else more could you ask for? So they're doing their job, for sure.
Okay. Last thing, and we'll wrap up here. We haven't talked about it because I want to save the worst for last, if you will.
Jeez.
The Browns secondary is not good. And Denzel Ward really struggling. Johnson really struggling. How concerned are you about this secondary?
I'm not.
Oh, okay.
I'm not. I don't think... Look, Denzel Ward had a couple great plays. I think it was with the Chiefs. John Johnson, look, again, I think it's just going to take a little bit of time. He's quite the talent, and we were really excited to get him on board. So I'm not worried about the Browns secondary. I think that they're going to be just fine. Again, I think it's just more of, you know, timing. And Denzel Ward was out for a while. When was he out? Boy, last year's running into me now. Because he got hurt last year. So there's, again, I think, too, going back to the kind of the preseason comment that we talked about, if they have a little bit more time to play and more time to gel, I think September looks a little bit different for a lot of teams. But I don't think they're anywhere near worse or better than anyone. I feel like people forget how close the NFL is really with the talent from the top to bottom. And I think this year too, we're learning that, you know, we thought we were going to kill Houston, right? Coming in. That didn't happen. Pittsburgh went into Buffalo, right? And the Ravens went, you know, against Kansas City and got the W. So I don't think there's a major, major gap. So if that makes you feel better about your Atlanta Falcons, but I don't think there's a major gap between the top and the bottom this year so far.
I would disagree, as having watched all of the Atlanta Falcons this year and a lot of other NFL games, I can tell you for sure there is a gap. There is quite a gap.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. I mean, I think there's just a lot of talent that is still getting gelled out on a lot of different teams. And I think that the Browns are no different from that. I'm not worried. I'm a very optimistic Browns fan right now. And I appreciate you trying to, you know, give me a couple cracks in my glass heart here of the Browns. But
If I was not a nice guy, then I would ask you this question of like, which LSU secondary guy is your favorite in this Browns unit? Is it Grant Delpit or is it Greedy Williams?
I like Delpit. Boy, he had quite the hit.
What would you guess Greedy Williams' coverage grade per PFF is to this point in the season?
It's got to be pretty shitty.
It's 31.5. Pretty shitty.
Okay. Yeah. See.
Greg Newsom, yeah, though, he's good. Greg Newsom's going to be a player.
I like Greg Newsom, too. Yeah, no. Well, like I said, we got a lot. Our talent is rivaling one of the best.
Yeah, if they didn't come from the Rams, you're fine.
Look, I'm looking forward. Jeez, I got my rose-colored glasses on.
Right.
I am here. It's a week by week.
Well, if there's one thing history can tell us, it's that the Browns are going to be fine. That is a sentence that Could no, never come back to haunt you.
We can't get worse. We literally could not have gotten worse than we did. We hit rock bottom. And sometimes you do got to hit rock bottom to move forward. I think overall the Browns under Stefanski, under Andrew Berry, you know, to kind of close on it, I guess, is it's a completely different culture. The guys there, they're there to work. They're there to do their job. They're there to show, you know, that they're talking. It's going to be on the field and how they play. Baker has grown up so much. I was very critical of him right in the 2019 season because, quite frankly, he had a terrible season. And
it's hard to have a great season when you're also having a great commercial career. You can't have both.
Well, now he is because now he's doing both and he's having it so far. So, and yeah, he was doing a lot of that stuff. And everyone's like, well, it's not that funny when you suck. So he's definitely turned that over. I saw him in person at training camp and he is jacked. Like his body is completely transformed. Looks so much stronger than he ever has. There's no dad bod situation going on like there was a couple years ago with him with pictures that came out. And it just, so it's all those guys have definitely made some major strides on a physical standpoint, of course, but also on a mental standpoint. I just, if anything, weirdly enough, I think COVID really made a big difference in the sense of it forced these guys to kind of just completely focus on what was at hand every week, every game, focus on their health, focus on, you know, the most important stuff. So it, weirdly enough, we grew and benefited off of that year in strange ways, not completely, but there were certain really big points that we took. And I think it's just not taking anything for granted and just being one game at a time. It's just that Stefanski's created such an awesome culture already being here. So I'm not worried. There are going to be mistakes. We are going to lose games. It's going to happen. We're going to make stupid decisions across the board. But and I don't know, you know, this year is going to be an interesting one, but it's definitely going to be a great growing one. And I think that, yeah, last year we proved it. And I think we're going to continue to that. We're Super Bowl contenders. We are. And that's crazy to say. I can't believe I just said that out loud, but it is a real thing. So
there you go. I'm pro Brown. So I should mention at the end of all of this that they were my preseason Super Bowl pick in the AFC.
Were they?
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Well, we'll welcome you. If you want to hang your hat, you know, on the Browns as your second team, we'll take you in for sure.
I don't know.
Browns tailgate.
I mean, my football Saturdays in the fall are pretty shitty. Like with Tennessee and Atlanta, like it's just it's a lot for me to handle the Vols and the Falcons in back-to-back days. I don't know if I'm able to do it for a full season this year. We're gonna see. At least Tennessee's a lot better this year, but I don't know. We'll have to see. It's a week by week situation. I mean, the Titans are sitting there, but I don't know. I don't know if I can make that AFC jump. And Julio being over there now, it's pretty fresh, right? Pretty fresh wound on that front. So I'm not sure.
Yes, come up and hang. I'll take you to tailgate. You know, you'll get the whole full Monty of Cleveland Browns.
There you go. There you go. We'll see. You never know, Holly. You never know. How do the good folks keep up with your work?
Well, please check out the Orange is Oranger Browns podcast on Apple Podcasts. Check me out on Twitter at Holly Ann Liz. And I also write for Awful Announcing on all things media sports rights. So check out all three.
Go do that if you have not already. Holly, thank you so much for making the time this evening. I greatly appreciate it. We will have to check back in again soon.
Sounds good. Thanks, Chase.
Nicely done, nephew. Chase Thomas Podcast. Hell yeah.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.